Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The United States imprisons more people than anyone else in the world, hands down. Not only is it the absolute number of people we imprison greater than any other nation, but we also lead in the percentage of our population that we lock up. These are shameful facts behind which lie many complex factors. And exploring those factors in a new book is James Kilgore. Kilgore knows a thing or two about prisons. He spent several years behind bars for his radical political activism in the 1970s via his membership in the Symbionese Liberation Army, or SLA. The SLA, as you may recall, was involved in the famed kidnapping of heiress Patty Hearst in 1974. Here is how a CBS News article described Kilgore's story. Quote, the Oregon native survived the 1974 shootout between the SLA and police in Los Angeles, in which six SLA members died. He disappeared in 1975. After more than 25 years on the run, U.S. federal marshals arrested Kilgore in South Africa, where he'd been living under an assumed name. He was extradited to the United States and later sentenced to 6 years in a prison. Well, James Kilgore is now an adjunct instructor of global studies and urban planning at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. His book is called Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. He now joins me live on the program. Welcome to Uprising.
Good morning, Sonali. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Well, you have quite a story, but your book focuses on the nitty-gritty of incarceration. Did your personal experience on the inside influence your book and become a factor in its uniqueness? We have books about mass incarceration, but I'm not sure how many have been written by somebody who spent 6 years themselves behind bars.
Absolutely. My prison experience shaped this book. During that 6.5 years, I saw an endless stream of black, brown, and poor white bodies coming through those prison gates. And most of them were serving incredible sentences, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, life, life without parole, double life. I had one friend who was doing 555 years. And when I found out their stories, the crimes that they had been convicted of, I couldn't quite figure out how that connected to the level of punishment that they were receiving. So this prompted me, when I was released from prison in 2009, to investigate this thing which I later found was called mass incarceration. And I became an activist in my own community around these issues, opposing a jail project in my county of Champaign County, Illinois. But also I began to research and write, because I'd been a researcher and an educator, a popular educator, before I was incarcerated. And I thought that there was a need for a book that described mass incarceration broadly, from Obama to Clinton to Reagan, from the war on immigrants to the war on drugs, but did it in an accessible way using the voices of people who were directly impacted. So that's how I set out to undertake this project of writing a book about which I've called the key civil rights struggle of our era.
And in fact, on that specific phrase that you use, how much of that has to do with the fact that this system that we have in the United States impacts the poor and specifically people of color most so? Does that fact highlight that not only is this a system that's insidious in how many people it brings into its dragnet, but that it targets vulnerable ones?
Absolutely. As many people know through the writings of Michelle Alexander and others, the African-American population in prisons and jails is about 40%, more than double their rate in the general population. In the state where I live, in Illinois, African-Americans make up 15% of the general population, 58% of those in prison. But I think it's also important to recognize that mass incarceration is not simply about locking people up, but that it's an approach to how we deal with poverty, how we deal with poor people's problems. Instead of providing welfare support, social services, instead of allocating resources into those communities, we've chosen to punish poverty, to punish the poor, with the direct result that a disproportionate amount of the prison population is people of color, and the communities that they come from have been devastated by the loss of those people to prisons and jails, and also by the policing activities that have been taking place there, largely as a result of the war on drugs and more recently wars on immigrants.
And I want to get to those two wars in particular and how casting them as wars is crucial. The prison population, however, didn't sort of balloon in a vacuum. It grew. It wasn't just politicians who've pushed this, right? It's grown with the permission of at least some sectors of U.S. society.
Absolutely. But I think there's been a concerted effort to create a public mindset, to generate a fear of crime, a fear of the criminals. And the media has played a big role in this. If you look at the, for example, if you look at the increased coverage of crime stories on local news from the 1970s to the 1990s, we know now that if it bleeds, it leads. And almost every night, if you look at that local news, you're going to see a crime story, sometimes quite a minor story, leading rather than much more important events that are taking place elsewhere. And then we had the creation of these kind of media figures who became emblematic of the criminal. We had the case of Willie Horton in 1988, who was released from prison on a furlough program and then committed some crimes on that furlough, some violent crimes while on furlough, but he had been released by Michael Dukakis, who was the governor of Massachusetts at the time, who was campaigning for president. And George Bush used the image of Willie Horton against Michael Dukakis in a successful run to gain the presidency. Similar on the female side, we had the creation of the welfare queen by Ronald Reagan, casting African-American women in particular as those who were living off welfare checks in multiple identities, driving Cadillacs, living in five-story mansions, et cetera, all off the taxpayer dollar. And this was calculated to raise the ire of, in particular, socially conservative white voters who were upset at the fact that somehow their tax dollars were being misused by these kinds of people.
Now, one of the powerful statements you make about how racism permits mass incarceration is, quote, "Blacks are the repository for the American fear of crime." I thought that was a really eloquent and very powerful statement. Can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, you just did it to an extent, but also when it comes to interactions between police and African Americans, that statement in particular becomes crucial.
Well, certainly we've seen the reactions of police to African Americans in the recent cases in Sandra Bland, Sam Dubose, and so forth, where we've had very vivid video coverage of what are really everyday kinds of events, that the ones that we've seen are the ones that have gone horribly wrong. But on a day-to-day basis, we're seeing these kinds of encounters where there's an assumption when a person is driving while black that they're up to no good, and that they're subject to search, to all kinds of unreasonable requests, and in many cases physical abuse, even to the point of death. And if we look at the stop and frisk policies in New York, if we look at cases, studies of racial profiling of traffic stops in Minneapolis, and even in the town where I live, in Urbana, Illinois, we find that there's a disproportionate number of African-American drivers who are pulled over, even though the evidence shows they're less likely to be to have contraband in their cars than similarly profiled white drivers.
How serious a role has money played in the expansion of the prison industrial complex? Imprisonment is supposed to be a government affair, but today many prisons and detention centers are run by for-profit corporations, which means that the more people we imprison, the more money these companies make, and that is just a perversion.
Absolutely. I think I like to describe the prison industrial complex as a public-private partnership. And I think in some circles, there's a tendency to blame all of this, for example, on the private prison operators. But really, private prisons only control about 9% of the prison beds in the United States. So they, in some senses, are a minor player. And there's a much broader range of corporate interests that kind of get off the hook in terms of making the profits from this system. So we have construction companies, we have even major finance houses like Goldman Sachs have been involved in underwriting the bonds that were used to build a whole array of prisons in California in the 1990s. And then we have the service providers in prison, companies like Securus Technologies that made $114 million last year off of prison phone calls. We have Aramark Food Corporation, we have Corizon Health Services. All of these are feeding at the trough of the budgets of mass incarceration. And it's a big economic project, but underlying it is a political project about how we solve problems of poverty, homelessness, mental health, substance abuse, etc. And that's the where the public sector comes in, and where the change in the state from a state that focused on providing at least some semblance of a social safety net to a state whose main task seems to be providing profit opportunities for private corporations and pushing security.
And of course, at the heart of all of these stories is the fact that there are living, breathing fellow Americans, human beings, in some cases immigrants, existing behind bars. And one of the things that sets your books apart from this on this subject is that occasionally you include poetry. You have even a section on music from the prison system. And I like this poem that you put in your book by a lifer named Joseph Dole. I just want to read for my audience a couple of paragraphs or stanzas of this. It's called American Supermax. A guard informed me upon arrival that there are benefits to this isolation. He promoted the fact that we are now all safe from gang retaliation. I had to ask, but what of the retaliation of the prison administration? He smiled cryptically as he enjoyed this in ecstatic contemplation. Several more stanzas, but I thought that was really powerful. Why did you include this?
Well, I think it's really important in terms of building a social movement to resist, to overturn, to destroy mass incarceration, that people who have been incarcerated, who are incarcerated, and their families and communities are playing a leading role in this, and we hear their voices. We have lots of academic studies, and these are very important, but we need to also include the voices of those who have been locked up. They have a different perspective, and as well as their families, their children, their partners, and so forth. And there's kind of a stereotype that people have about people who are incarcerated. Somehow they think that when we're in prison, we sit in our cell all day depressed, kind of looking out a window at a gray wall or something. But prisons have their own ways of developing activities, of developing forms of resistance. And even if we're not at all times seeing people doing heroic actions, doing hunger strikes, doing other kinds of activities, on a day-to-day basis, people find ways to resist the authority of the administration, to resist the dehumanization of being incarcerated. And one of the ways people do this is by writing. So that's why I've included the works of Joseph Dole, for example, because he's written many poems, but he's also written an entire book doing a life sentence in the Illinois state prison system. He's written an entire book about mass incarceration in the prison system. So these are critical voices. And I think organizations like All of Us or None, organizations like A New Way of Life in Los Angeles have played a big role in bringing out those voices.
Now, I want to go back to what you brought up earlier, which is that there are many aspects to why people get fed into the prison system. The war on drugs is one that we talk about a lot. There's also the war on immigrants, which has become a sort of a new feeder into the prison system. It's been around for a long time, but it's been expanded quite a bit. Why does putting these issues into the context of war make sense?
Well, because I think we're attacking these problems as if we're fighting a foreign enemy. I mean, we're attacking them with border patrols. We're attacking them with security walls. We could call those high security fences, the same kinds of things that we put around prisons. So the major thrust of this has been a law enforcement thrust around dealing with immigration. And I think it's important to recognize that while I've talked about how the private prisons don't control a huge sector of the prison and jail system, they do play a very important role in immigration. Immigration has become the cash cow for corporations like the Corrections Corporations of America and the GEO Group, the major players who hold about 40% of the immigration detention cells and are constantly hiring lobbyists and so forth to press for harsher immigration laws in order to expand their market base. So this is a particular area where immigrants' rights activists have focused on these private prisons because they can see that this is one of the areas where they've really succeeded in carving out a market niche and growing it. And since the year 2000, we've seen in particular that the percentage of people locked up who are Latino has grown dramatically.
And you have a whole section in your book on women called The Gendered Threads of Punishment, focusing on the women whose loved ones are in prison, but then on women prisoners themselves. But something like 90% of all people in prison in the U.S. are men. Why is it important to look at the gendered side of this?
Well, although 90% of the people in prison may be men, they leave behind families, largely led by women, mothers, grandmothers, sisters, partners, and so forth, children. And these families have to cope with the difficulty of having an incarcerated loved one. First of all, in many cases, it removes a major source of financial support. There's the emotional and the parenting duties that those left behind need to carry out in a situation where the kinds of social services and welfare benefits are being reduced. And then there's also the extra burden of just supporting someone directly when they're incarcerated. Prison phone calls have become hugely expensive. There's campaigns against that now. But when I was in prison, I was paying $1 a minute for a phone call. Some places they pay even more than that. Most of our prisons in many states are sited in remote rural areas, which are a long journey from the urban areas where the majority of people who are incarcerated live. So visiting becomes a major expense. All of these kinds of things add up to a tremendous collateral consequence of mass incarceration that's often neglected, largely, I believe, because of a gender bias, right, that we don't really see these issues in a complex way, including a gender lens.
Finally, James, the whole premise of prisons is supposed to be rehabilitation, and clearly we've come very, very far away from that. You end your book discussing the concepts of restorative justice, taking your cue from a lot of local organizations around the country that have begun to try to change the conversation on prisons. Can you end with giving us some ideas that you lay out in your book on how the prison system needs to desperately be reformed?
Well, there's the reform within the prison to re-inject some kind of ethos of rehabilitation in the prison. But I don't think that should be our major focus. Our major focus needs to be on measures that keep people from going to prison and then get more people out of prison. So changing the approach, changing the mindset is key. We need to get away from this notion that we have to punish people and punish people to the extreme for harm done or wrongs they may have committed. Restorative justice takes a step in that direction by getting people to look toward solutions that don't involve incarceration, that may involve dialogue between people, say in the case of an assault or the case of a household robbery. The idea of restorative justice is to get the people who are involved in that together to talk about why it happened and see if some kind of compensation might be able to be paid rather than having someone be incarcerated. But I think more important is the notion of transformative justice, which says that not only do we need to do those restorative practices, but we need to dig deeper and find out what is the cause of why we're locking people up and transform that system, because it's the system that's locking people up. It's the system of laws, the system of policing, and the social welfare system that's operating under a punitive basis that needs to be transformed in order to stop that flow of bodies into the prisons.
James, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck to you with your book.
Thank you very much, Sonali. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
My guest is James Kilgore. He is an adjunct instructor of global studies and urban planning at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And we've been discussing his book, Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. He spent 6 years in prison himself because of his role in the Symbionese Liberation Army. You can look up his story online. James Kilgore is his name, Kilgore. We'll be right back after this break.